Good morning. I'm Marty Bauman, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this meeting of the Standing Advisory Group. It's also my pleasure to welcome those listening in on the webcast. This meeting, like all of our meetings, is webcast. We have a new venue today. Apparently, Washington is very busy in July, so this room is a bit more crowded than the room we're normally in, and I see some people fanning themselves already. So we'll do our best to keep things cool. I'd like to start off by addressing some of our recent standard-setting activities very briefly, and then I'll do a brief summary of the agenda, and then I'll turn it over to our acting chairman, Dan Gelzer. As you know, the board recently proposed a new auditing standard regarding communications by auditors with audit committees. The comment period on that ended on May 28th. We received a lot of valuable comment letters, and later today we'll provide you with a summary of the comments we received. Very recently, on July 13th, the board proposed a new audit standard on confirmations. This standard, if adopted, would supersede the existing confirmation standard. The proposed standard recognizes the importance of audit evidence obtained from independent third parties, and in doing so, strengthens and extends the requirements for using confirmations in the audit process. We believe this proposed standard will improve audit quality and thereby further investor protection. A copy of this standard is in your binders, but I'll just cover a couple of the key provisions of the standard. Confirmations would be required for receivables and cash and for significant risks when confirmation adequately addresses the relevant assertions of the significant risk. The standard limits the circumstances where negative confirmations can be used and requires that because negative confirmations provide limited evidence, that auditors supplement negative confirmations with other audit procedures. The standard strengthens the requirements around the confirmation process, especially with respect to the auditor maintaining control over the process, and it more explicitly incorporates consideration of the risk of material misstatement due to error or fraud into the selection, design, and performance of confirmation procedures. It also recognizes the changes in technology and practices that have taken place since the original standard was issued, and addresses the use of electronic confirmations, the use of intermediaries, and the practice of auditors getting confirmation via direct access into respondents' records. And the auditor is required to evaluate the effect of disclaimers, which seem to be ever-increasing and restrictive language, on the reliability of a confirmation response. The proposed standard contains numerous changes from the existing confirmation standard, and it also contains significant differences from the analogous standards of the IAASB and the Auditing Standards Board. As we've done with other standards that we've proposed recently or issued, there is an appendix in the standard which compares this standard to the analogous standard of the IAASB and the Auditing Standards Board. Comments on the confirmation standard are due by September 13th. We also just issued a practice alert number 6 regarding situations where U.S. auditors are issuing reports on companies whose operations reside almost entirely outside of the United States, but where we have observed that the U.S. auditor was not appropriately following PCAOB audit standards in either using the work of the other auditor under AU 543 or supervising the work of the auditors doing the work under AU 311. You may recall that we discussed this at some length at the last SAG meeting and all viewed this as a significant practice problem. The practice alert reminds firms of their obligations when using the work of other firms or using assistance engaged from outside of the firms. With respect to the risk assessment standards, which we have proposed, reproposed, and gone over the comments with you, according to our standard-setting agenda, we plan to propose those standards to the board for final issuance in the third quarter of this year. We still think we're on schedule and on target to propose those seven or so standards to the board during this quarter. So as we've discussed with you before, we're stepping up our standard-setting activities, and I think the recent activity shows that we're trying to stay on that course. In fact, we're adding some more projects to our already busy standard-setting agenda. We'll discuss some potential standard-setting projects regarding the auditor's report and audits of broker-dealers during this meeting. So speaking of this meeting, let me turn just briefly to the agenda. I'll just give a very brief overview. The first topic we'll discuss pertains to is forward-looking. We continue to expect that legislation that is pending in Congress will give the PCAOB greater authority with respect to the audits of non-public broker-dealers. That authority could include, we expect to include, inspection, enforcement, and standard-setting authority. We want to discuss with the SAG members and receive your input about some of the issues we'll have to address with respect to this new standard-setting authority. The next agenda topic is even more forward-looking. As has been widely publicized, significant changes to many accounting standards are expected as a result of projects, both joint and individual, of the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the International Accounting Standards Board. A panel will discuss these upcoming changes, and we'll ask the SAG to consider implications on this change, both in its pace and its volume, on audits and the audit profession. One thing I'd like to ask is that we try to keep this particular discussion to a discussion of the impact of the pace of change and the volume of change on audits and auditors, and not on the accounting standards themselves. This afternoon, we'll discuss a possible standard-setting project on the responsibility of auditors related to identifying and reporting on events occurring subsequent to the financial statement date, but before the issuance of the auditor's report. This period can provide very relevant, informative, and meaningful information regarding matters that exist at the financial statement date or matters that arise after that date, which are important to investors. We'll seek your input on the auditor's role during this period, as well as the period after the report date, but before the financial statements are issued. We'll then turn to another topic that we discussed with the SAG before, and that is the auditor's report. This topic's been discussed for many years in many different forums. We are going to discuss our approach to addressing it from a standard-setting perspective, and we're going to try to present a very solutions-oriented approach to really make progress on this matter. And as I said, finally, we'll update you on the recent proposed standard on communications with audit committees. So I think we have a busy and informative and interesting agenda today. And as always, we greatly seek your active input during the meeting. Just as a reminder, whenever you want to discuss a point, just please put your name card on its edge, and we'll call on you. Now, with that, I'll turn the floor over to Dan Gelzer, Acting Chairman, for comments about recent events and other important matters.
Thanks very much, Marty. I'd also like to join in welcoming everyone to the July 2010 meeting of the Board's Standing Advisory Group. As always, we appreciate the fact that you're willing to take time from your schedules to help us in our work. Marty's highlighted some developments related to standard setting. I thought I would just touch on a few other developments affecting the board outside of the standard setting area, particularly the Supreme Court decision, the status of our foreign inspections program, the plan to create a center on the prevention and detection of fraud, and some additional comments about the impact of the changes in our broker-dealer responsibilities. First, the Supreme Court decision. I assume by now everyone is well aware that on June 28th, the Supreme Court issued its decision in the litigation that's been running for the last close to 3 years now, challenging the constitutionality of the board. In essence, of course, the court held that the provision in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that made board members, PCOB board members, removable only for cause by the SEC was invalid. The underlying concern was that since the SEC commissioners themselves are only removable for cause, we were too insulated from presidential control by those two levels of for-cause removal. The court severed that provision from the statute. That is, it found that Congress would rather have had a PCOB with at-will removal of board members than no PCOB at all, so it simply, in effect, cut that provision out of the statute. There were also challenges to the way that board members are appointed, whether that was consistent with the Appointments Clause of the Constitution, and we prevailed on all of those issues, which was important because it's very unlikely that the court could have addressed those issues through severance. In other words, it would have been necessary to go back to the Congress in order to preserve the PCOB. So just what does it all mean? What's the fallout? Well, as the court itself said, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act remains fully operative as a law. There was some suggestion that the entire Sarbanes-Oxley Act might somehow fall if there were problems with the PCOB provisions. That certainly was not the case. We continue to function as we always have. I guess the meeting this morning is a demonstration of that. And we believe that there's nothing in the decision that in any way invalidates any standards, rules, or other actions that we've taken during the past 7 years. That's also a question that has arisen, but in our view, the decision doesn't invalidate any of our prior actions. Let me turn then to our foreign inspections program. There's been discussion with this group and in other public forums about our the difficulties that we've encountered in conducting some of our foreign inspections. It was particularly a topic of discussion at the inaugural meeting of our investor advisory group, which some of you were also at in this same room several months ago. So let me give a bit of a status report. We are still, of course, unable to conduct inspections in any of the European Union jurisdictions, in Switzerland, or in China. This certainly has a significant effect on our ability to meet our statutory responsibilities to inspect all of the auditors that, whose audit reports are filed with the SEC. This year, we're currently scheduled to inspect 81 non-U.S. firms in 28 countries. 43 of those 81 firms are in the EU, Switzerland, or China. However, there are active efforts ongoing in order to resolve these issues, particularly with the EU and Switzerland currently. As to the EU specifically, the European Commission has a group or a subgroup called the Audit Regulatory Oversight Group that is voting this week on what they would call an interim adequacy determination with respect to the PCOB. That would permit our inspections to go forward in the EU at least for a period of years. It would have to also apparently be approved or at least not objected to by the European Parliament, but we're at least cautiously optimistic that that process can work itself out in the next month or so. We would then have to begin bilateral negotiations with each of the individual EU states in which we need to conduct inspections, but presumably, hopefully, at least in most cases, that could proceed fairly rapidly. One of the major sticking points in our relations with our foreign colleagues has been our inability to share confidential inspections information with them. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act has fairly strict provisions in it about our ability to disclose non-public inspections information, and they don't extend to non-U.S. regulators. There is a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill that would correct that situation and let us, on pretty much the same terms as we can provide information to U.S. audit oversight bodies and other regulatory authorities in the United States, share information with non-U.S. Audit oversight bodies. I guess I haven't heard anything new this morning, but I think the assumption is that that bill will pass the Senate today, I guess, at least sometime this week, and then presumably be signed by the President next week. So hopefully we're on the road to addressing that issue, which will remove at least one of the stumbling blocks to our reaching agreement with some of our foreign colleagues. At the same time, there's been discussion, I think, with this group and also with some of our other advisory bodies about the disclosure that we make concerning the status of our foreign inspections. And we do have various kinds of lists on our website as to the countries in which we've been able to inspect, firms that have not been inspected for 4 years despite being subject to inspection, that sort of thing. On May 18th, we added a list of the issuers. We have a list of approximately 400 non-U.S. issuers whose last audit report was filed by or was written by a firm that we can't inspect because it's in a jurisdiction that we're unable to get into. And I think we thought that it was quite important that investors be able to understand not simply the identity of the audit firm, but the identity of the company in which they might be investing where we're not able to perform our statutory inspection functions. I would stress that I don't by any means see that disclosure as a substitute for conducting the inspections, and we do intend to pursue both through negotiations and through the other regulatory tools at our disposal the fact that we need to conduct those inspections. But again, we thought it was important that the public understand the companies involved, and we will continue to update that list and the other lists from time to time. The Anti-Fraud Center. I believe at the last meeting of this group, I mentioned that we had just recently published a posting for a director of a center on the prevention and detection of fraud. This was one of the recommendations that came to us from the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession. There was considerable interest in that position. We received 24 applications, and many of them from people who would be extremely well qualified to head the center, and a staff committee is currently screening those. There'll be interviews of some of the finalists, and I guess I would say that I would hope at the next meeting of this group I'll be able to announce, or we will have announced, the head of the Fraud Center and perhaps be able to talk more about that organization's or that entity's work in preventing and detecting fraud. Certainly one of the responsibilities of the director will be to structure the Fraud Center's work. Finally, Marty's already touched a little on our broker-dealer authority, and that is going to be the subject of the next panel. Let me just say a couple of things about the impact on us apart from standard-setting activities. I think most of you are probably familiar with the general background. Section 17E of the Exchange Act requires all securities brokers that are registered with the SEC to file audited financial statements with the Commission, and Sarbanes-Oxley required the auditors who signed those audit reports to be registered with the PCAOB. There were a series of exemptive orders that prevented that provision from going into effect, but they expired at the end of 2008, and as a result, roughly 500 additional auditing firms have registered with us over the last year and a half or so. There are roughly 5,000 securities broker-dealers registered with the SEC in the United States, so this is a fairly large additional universe of companies and auditors that comes under our jurisdiction. Sarbanes-Oxley, however, does not give the board any authority to inspect these firms, to write standards for the way they perform their audits and the other kinds of reports that they're required to file with the SEC, or to bring enforcement actions against them with respect to those engagements. Again, however, the Dodd-Frank legislation would address that problem. Section 982, for those who are accounting, of the statute would essentially extend our inspection, standard setting, and enforcement authority to those 500 or so firms that are now registered with us and the audits they perform of broker-dealers. The bill also creates a funding stream to pay for that work. Essentially, the broker-dealers whose financial statements are audited by firms registered with us would have to pay an annual support fee similar to the fee paid by public companies to support or defray the cost of that part of our program. The fee would be calculated in proportion to each broker-dealer's net capital, or to reflect the proportion that each broker's net capital bears to the total net capital of broker-dealers in the United States. Section 982 could also change the registration landscape somewhat in that it only requires the registration of firms that are subject to a PCOB inspection program. And I think that reflects the fact that Congress had questions at least about whether we should be inspecting the entire universe of these broker-dealers. Some are simply what are called introducing brokers that don't have, at least in theory, don't have access to customer cash or securities. Both the SIPC and the SEC staff were on record as part of the legislative process stressing that they felt we should have jurisdiction over all of the broker-dealer firms. The AICPA and some others took a different view. So the result was to, in effect, kind of kick that issue over to us through rulemaking. So I guess the only point I would conclude with is that when the legislation passes, assuming it's going to pass, we'll have a lot to do in order to add this new responsibility to our work. We'll have to create an inspection program to cover these broker-dealers. There'll be standard-setting responsibilities, which are the subject of the next panel here this morning. We'll have a new funding system to put in place, and we'll have a new aspect of our enforcement program. That completes the summary that I wanted to, the topics I wanted to cover. I guess with some trepidation, I'll say if there are any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. Otherwise, we're ready for the next topic. Lynn.
Dana, three questions for you. Two on the inspections and one on the anti-fraud center, and it sounds like you're actually starting to make progress on the foreign inspections, which I think is great news. In what the EU is working on, are they putting any limitations on your ability to go in and do the foreign inspections? Are there certain protocols? Are they requiring their people go in with you? What, if any, limits are they putting on them, or are they going to let you go ahead and do an inspection much like you do here in the U.S.? And either you or a question also for Brian, the list that you put out is excellent in terms of the 400 registrants, but most investors wouldn't have a clue that that list is out there. Either through the auditor's report or other disclosure, have either of you considered requiring those 400 registrants to make disclosure of the fact that their audits haven't been inspected? That's the second question. Then finally, on the anti-fraud center, getting the new director on is certainly a good progress, but how many people are you budgeting now then to be in the anti-fraud center along with the director?
See, I don't think Rhonda Schneer is here this morning. As to the EU, at least my understanding is that in what they're looking at, there's nothing that would limit our ability, the way that we conduct our foreign inspections. They are thinking, I believe, of a time limitation, probably something in the neighborhood of 3 years, so that these issues would come back again in 3 years. I think I can say with some confidence that we wouldn't be able to agree to any limitations because, obviously, anything we agree to with one country, we're then almost forced to agree to it with all countries, and so we can't go down that kind of road. But, again, I'm not aware that they're considering that anything that would be problematic in that regard. There, as I said, there would then have to be negotiations, as there always are, with each individual jurisdiction about the exact terms and conditions and protocol under which inspections would occur in that country, but that is something that we're fairly used to doing. It's the day-to-day work of our Office of International Affairs. As to disclosure in audit opinions, when we're not able to inspect the firm, I think that's been discussed publicly, is that is definitely something that would be on the agenda of steps that we could take. I think the feeling, at least to date, has been if it looks like there's a realistic possibility of solving these problems and going in and performing the inspections, then we don't have to turn to that step or other kinds of steps that we could take. But I think it's very much on all our minds that process can't go on forever. I mean, at some point we have to turn to these other steps. And as to the staffing of the fraud center, I mean, I don't think there's really an answer to that question at the moment. We're now in the process of formulating what our 2011 budget submission to the SEC would be like. Nothing's been submitted yet, and I don't believe there's been any discussion with the SEC staff about that topic. I don't think it currently envision that next year the staff would be large, probably more in the range of two or three, something like that. But again, a lot of that is because the director is, and I guess we have kind of broad ideas about what the center would be, but somebody's going to have to be put in that position and then really come up with a detailed plan as to how the center would operate and what it would do, and then I think its ultimate staffing would fall out of that plan.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you noted that the Anti-Fraud Center is directly responsive to one of the recommendations of the Treasury Committee report. Can you just briefly give us an update of the status and timing of your responses to the other Treasury Committee recommendations?
I did that in April, and it took me about a half an hour. And we have put that list on the website. I guess we ought to look to updating that list as there are developments. Jeff, I think about all I can say at the moment is that we're quite mindful of all those recommendations and do intend to keep working on them. I mean, the auditor's reporting model is certainly a big subject that's also on the agenda for this meeting. I know there's a lot of interest in engagement partner signature of the audit report, and I think what the published standards agenda says is that the staff would be making a recommendation to the board during the second quarter, which ended a few days ago, and any further action would occur during the third quarter. So I'll let it go at that.
But. Yeah, on that particular one, I think that's something where we're prepared to, and our Office of General Counsel together are prepared to sit down with the board and talk about next steps on that one right now. So I think that'll be an issue that during the third quarter we'll have discussions with the board about next steps. If there are no other questions, we'll proceed to the next topic on the agenda, which pertains to audits of broker-dealers and the pending legislation in that regard, but our potential standard-setting authority with respect to that. I'll ask Bill Gradison to please make some introductory comments on the matter. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Marty. I think I've been asked to do this because when I was out in the real world before I contracted Potomac fever, I made a living as a general partner of a non-public broker-dealer and had a lot of contact with our outside auditors, Haskins and Sells at the time, now part of Deloitte. I think that it's important to recognize that we actually have registered a lot of auditors of non-public broker-dealers in the past if they were also auditing issuers. So the new universe are auditors who don't currently audit issuers, but just audit non-public broker-dealers. And that registration part of the process is pretty well complete, up 4,500, whatever the numbers are. But that's just the first step. There are a lot of other things that are going to have to happen for this program to work effectively. A specialized training will be required to perform these inspections with all that that entails with regard to recruitment and training. And it's going to require a significant increase in our PCOB headcount. It's not that we don't have inspectors with knowledge in this field. We have some very able ones, but we don't have enough to go out at all, to go out and do this work in addition to their other responsibilities. As Dan has mentioned, a system of fees will have to be put into effect so that issuers can be assured that they are not carrying the cost of this new program. Each of those would have to stand on its own. And in November of this year, the PCOB budget proposal will go to the SEC for next year, And it's going to, of course, have to cover the responsibilities, these new responsibilities. And that budget process, as Dan has mentioned, it's going along. But there are a lot of elements that feed into the additional costs that will be entailed, not just the inspection element, although that's the largest part. And that'll be, of course, has to be in a form and an amount that's satisfactory to the SEC. With regard to standards for issuers, though, this is a very different situation than we faced back in our early days in 2003, because we were permitted by statute to adopt on an interim basis the then existing ASB, if you will, standards. And so we had something to start with, but my best understanding, and we'll learn a lot more about this in the next hour, of the situation with regard to broker-dealer standards is that we sort of start with a clean slate. And this is going to mean an enormous challenge, not just in terms of substance, but in terms of the timing. I mean, it takes time to write these standards and to seek comments and to respond to the comments and, you know, work it all through the SEC. And that's going to be a big job. Another fundamental difference is that unlike conventional audits, which, of course, are focused on the accuracy and the reliability of financial reporting, broker-dealer audits include control over customer assets, which are not included in the broker-dealer's financial statements, as well as the very important verification of that the broker-dealer meets the net capital requirements. Unlike a PCOB statutory role, and these are the words of the statute, you know, protecting investors through improving the accuracy and reliability of corporate disclosures, in the case of broker-dealer audits, the focus is on protecting the investor as a customer rather than as as an owner or a creditor of a public company, which I think is somewhat significant. These are uncharted waters for the PCOB, and we look forward in the next hour of having your views on how we should proceed. And now I'll turn it over to Barb. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, and good morning and welcome. As Marty mentioned, our discussion topic on broker-dealers is somewhat unique to other discussion topics in that, as of today, we don't yet have the authority to inspect, investigate, or discipline the auditors of non-public broker-dealers. However, due to the magnitude of the possible effect of getting this authority, we did think it was timely to talk to you about it today, as there would probably be a great desire to move expeditiously once we get it. A significant aspect of getting this potential authority is that the board would need to expand rules and standards to cover the audits of broker-dealers, which would likely include developing or amending existing audit, attest, and related professional practice standards that we have today. So today we're hoping to provide you with an overview of the current regulatory requirements relating to the audits of broker-dealers, and then to seek your views on certain aspects of these audits. Broker-dealer is defined broadly in the securities law. A broker-dealer is an individual or firm that is engaged in the business of trading securities for its own account or on behalf of its customers. It operates in an industry that is highly regulated. Broker-dealers must be registered with the SEC and are subject to a number of rules and regulatory requirements. Two significant SEC rules that we'll talk about throughout this discussion are Rule 15.3-1, which is the net capital requirements for broker-dealers. It establishes that broker-dealers must maintain adequate liquid assets to meet their capital requirements. And Rule 15.C.3-3, which is a customer protection rule regarding reserves and custody of securities. It requires, among other things, to have a broker-dealer establish a special reserve account for the protection of customers. And it also requires that a broker-dealer have custody or control of certain customer securities. The applicability of these rules and some of the regulatory reporting requirements may vary based on the nature of the business activities of each broker-dealer. For example, an introducing broker-dealer may accept customer orders but clears or processes the orders through another broker known as a clearing broker. The clearing broker, among other things, receives and executes customer instructions and settles the money related to trades. Because introducing brokers do not hold customer accounts, they typically don't have to comply with Rule 15C3-3 regarding possession and control of securities. Broker-dealers are required to be members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which has responsibility for oversight of the over-the-counter securities market. With limited exceptions, broker-dealers are also required to be members of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which serves a similar purpose as the FDIC, and is designed to protect up to a specific maximum amount customer cash and securities in the event the broker-dealer fails and is liquidated. Broker-dealers must file annual financial statements with the SEC, who has established rules regarding audit requirements. Specifically, Rule 17A5 requires that annual reports made by broker-dealers include audited financial statements. It also requires the audit to include a review of the accounting system, the internal accounting and control, and procedures for safeguarding securities, as well as for the audit to include all procedures necessary to enable the auditor to express an opinion on the financial statements, including the computation of net capital under Rule 15C3-1, the computation for the determination of the reserve under 15C3-3, and information regarding the possession or control requirements under Rule 15C3-3. The SEC rule further requires that the scope of the audit and review of the internal accounting system and internal control and procedures, they require the auditor to provide reasonable assurance that any material inadequacies existing at the date of the examination in the areas of these rules are disclosed. Rule 17A5, however, does not include specific requirements regarding the extent and timing of audit procedures. Broker-dealers must file their audited financial statements with the SEC within 60 days of their fiscal year end, along with the auditor's report on internal control required by Rule 17A5, and a supplemental report by the auditor which includes procedures related to the SIPC Annual General Assessment Reconciliation Form. The audit opinion that is filed with the financial statements includes a paragraph which covers the required supplementary schedules regarding the reserve calculation and the net capital calculation. Currently, the auditor's report on internal control required by Rule 17A5 is not specifically addressed in the standards of the AICPA, nor would there be a specific PCAOB standard which would address this report if we were given authority to inspect broker-dealers. An example of the form of the report, which is currently accepted by the SEC, is included in the AICPA's Audit and Accounting Guide on Broker-Dealers and Securities. In understanding how the audits of broker-dealers are unique to the audits of issuers, which we would now inspect, it's important to understand that customer securities held by broker-dealers are neither measured in a broker-dealer's financial statements, nor are they disclosed in the footnotes to the broker-dealer's financial statements. For example, in a bank's financial statements, the deposits of customers are reflected as a liability on the bank's balance sheet and are thus likely subject to audit procedures in the audit of a bank. The investments reflected in the financial statements of a broker-dealer represent only the broker-dealer's proprietary positions and not customer positions. Broker-dealers maintain a separate set of books referred to as the stock record, in which they record both their customer and their own securities transaction. As only the broker-dealer's proprietary position is reflected in its audited financial statements, an examination of the stock record that reflects customer securities may not necessarily be an integral part of the financial statement audit. The extent of audit procedures performed on the stock record may vary among firms because there are currently no specific audit requirements in the AICPA's auditing standards pertaining to customer securities. While many auditors use the AICPA audit guide on broker-dealers, which includes a number of suggested procedures that the auditor should perform, the audit guides are not authoritative, and as such, the suggested procedures are not requirements. As I think Dan mentioned, there are now approximately 500 firms that have registered with the PCAOB because they audit non-public broker-dealers and have therefore not necessarily applied the rules and standards of the PCAOB. So considering this, along with the regulatory requirements that are numerous regarding the audit, the staff today is seeking your view on what audit attest and professional practice standards the board may need to consider for broker-dealer audits. This brings us to our first discussion question. Oops. Because of existing SEC requirements, would the PCAOB need to establish specific auditing attest or professional practice standards for broker-dealer audits? And if so, what would they be? And I think we could probably also open it for the second discussion question at the same time, which is what other matters would the PCAOB need to consider in developing these standards for broker-dealer audits? Wayne Collins?
Yeah, I would guess the beginning would be to look at the guide. Now it's in the guide, notwithstanding that there probably are some gaps with 1A in the guide. And even though it's not authoritative, and I think the preface to the guide indicates that, it does indicate that auditors that do not follow the recommendations in the guide should be prepared to justify why they did not. So, again, I wouldn't start with a blank piece of paper. I'd start with the guide and then and chisel around it and add those things which need to be added. And in looking at the report on as broker-dealer auditors call it, the MI letter, is the report on the controls, the material inadequacies, there are some inconsistencies within that report. There's a definition of material weaknesses which relates to financial statements, and then there's a conclusion with respect to material weaknesses relating to both financial statements and safeguarding securities, so that seems to be inconsistent. And then there's a separate paragraph dealing with material inadequacies with respect to the system of safeguarding securities, yet material inadequacies is not defined in that report, although it is defined in the 17A5.
Galen Hansen.
Excuse me. I think I would start with that guide as well, but I would also roll back to have some discussions with the SEC about what they're seeing as exceptions and really going back to what is the objective that we're trying to accomplish here. I guess I'm a little bit bothered with the idea that it seems to me that the risk here is outside of the financial statements. It's in the stock record. And so either that stock record somehow needs to be reflected in the financial statements or the focus of the inspections need to be on the stock record. And I think that whole issue needs to be settled up front. As far as the standards themselves that the PCAOB would be thinking about, I think you're absolutely right. You got to go back through everything that you've already issued and see to what extent those are going to apply and how they apply to this. Do the independence rules apply to documentation standards? Is this an integrated audit? To what extent is that going to change the audit guide? I mean, this is a great opportunity for somebody to spend a lot of time.
As I've found out.
And I'm sure you've discovered that. So those are basically... But I'm sure that the SEC has had some issues that have evolved over the course of the years. We've been doing these reports for a long time, these audits for a long period of time. Certainly there have been some problems that could be focused on, and going back to some of the recent problems with broker dealers, what are those issues that led to those problems, and how can these inspections have any impact on those? Would be something that I think you'd be interested in.
Galen, I appreciate your comment that this is a great opportunity, and we'll look forward to this opportunity. I'm sure it'll keep Barbara and some others busy. I think the point Galen made is very important. I think it's worth reflecting just for a moment on it, and I see a lot of other cards up, but I think the real reason this authority and our authority over the audits of non-public broker-dealers was given to us is really about, as Bill had mentioned before and as Galen has added to, it's the trillions of dollars of customer assets, your assets, everybody's assets around this table, that are not in the financial statements at all, not on the balance sheet, not in the footnotes, not anywhere, but they're held by these broker-dealers. And so I think it's the real important thing that's we're going to deal with in our standards, I believe, is not just the audit of those financial statements, but it's the audit and the reporting on the safeguarding and controls over trillions of dollars of customer assets that are outside the financial statements. So it's a very non-traditional sort of issue that we'll be dealing with here with compared to other audits of issuers that we've been performing. And as was mentioned, there's suggested procedures in the audit guide, but no requirements. Barbara Rover?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually precisely the point that I wanted to reinforce from what Galen said is, I mean, no one suddenly gave the PCAOB this authority because they were concerned primarily about the audits of the financial statements of non-public broker-dealers. The exemption, you know, the decision about extending the exemption for non-public broker-dealers came up at the time when the Madoff case was in the headlines, and nobody had the political courage to try to explain why these were actually two really sort of very different functions. But I think it actually does expose an area that may be subject to inadequate oversight, where there is a potential to strengthen, as you say, the audits of the maintenance of these customer accounts. It is fraught with danger. I mean, one of the big misconceptions about Madoff case, I mean, Madoff was lying. He said he didn't have any customers. I mean, so whether he would even come into the population that you would normally be looking at for these kind of audits is a question of how you determine the scope. And you sort of walk into a danger area where you then become one of the parties that's responsible for not catching something that isn't necessarily all that easily catchable when it's simply a matter of someone running two entirely different set of books, hiding operations in a different set of the company. So I think it would be beneficial, as Galen suggests, to start with as much of a data dump as you can get from the SEC, from FINRA, from the states, about the kind of cases that you're likely to have, the kind of problems that are likely to emerge in this area, to figure out, to trigger your thoughts about what procedures would be likely to catch them. Because it is, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It is an entirely different function that you're being asked to come in and perform.
Thank you.
Yeah, Marty, any color commentary you can provide about conversations you may have had with the SEC regarding where they're going with 17A5 and how that might interact with where you may be heading standard setting wise? I mean, you know, any rule that talks about notifications via telegram, as is articulated in the dialogue here, is probably in need of a refresh. But I think it's important, as Galen mentioned, to appropriately sequence where the SEC may be heading with the rule and how that might relate to standard setting.
We have been having dialogue on a regular basis recently with the SEC. And one of the issues I'll point out that is challenging is right now is that 17A5 requires, as Barbara had indicated, an audit that would provide reasonable assurance about any material inadequacies existing pertaining to the accounting system or the internal controls or procedures for safeguarding securities. The report, however, that's been filed under the AICPA guide, I think as you probably know, indicates a study of controls was done as part of planning the overall audit, but accordingly we do not express an opinion on the effectiveness of the company's internal control. So there's an existing disconnect between the requirements and the report that's been received. So that's one of the issues that we're working on is what should that report look like and what should be the procedures governing it. And we've been having some regular conversations with the SEC. Brian, I see your card is up, and so why don't you take the floor?
Thanks, Marty, and this is probably a particularly good time for me just to express the standard disclaimer, since this would be an area where rulemaking is likely in light of the Dodd-Frank Act, but it's been pointed out, and it's fair to say, that the principal requirements that we're talking about here today have been in place for well over 30 years, and so I think this does certainly provide a good opportunity to reconsider those requirements. But notwithstanding that, today's rules that have been discussed and summarized in the requirements of 17A5, certainly in terms of the net capital rule, the possession and control rule, and the box count rule are certainly a good place to start and have served us well. So the staff will certainly be thinking about that. In terms of the PCAOB's comprehensive oversight, I think an important question to really be thinking about here today is what transition time would be necessary to move to using PCAOB standards as opposed to the standards of the AICPA, and really looking to the current SEC rules as a starting point for that discussion, notwithstanding that the staff may very well may have some recommendations for improvements or enhancements to that rule. And as has also been pointed out, it's certainly fair to say the staff is aware that the report being accepted today may not fit squarely into the existing standards, but the audit guide does provide some background, I think, that bridges that report a bit. So clearly it'll be a coordinated approach, and I think, you know, the conversation and dialogue is very useful around what the PCAOB might be able to think about in terms of updating their standards in this environment.
Thanks, Brian. Kurchak?
Thanks. This is pretty confusing issue for those of us that are sort of on the outside looking in at the auditing policies. What happens in the context of a publicly traded broker-dealer? Is PCAOB looking at any of these customer safety issues in the context of those audit reviews?
There are, to the best of my knowledge, very few publicly traded broker-dealers. I mean, they're part of a holding company where the issuer is not the broker-dealer. The issuer is the holding company that may have other activities. And I think most broker-dealers that are some of the larger ones are embedded in a holding company. And so the issuer's financial statements that we've had inspection authority over, we've been looking at the issuer's financial statements and the audit of those financial statements of the holding company, and not necessarily the compliance reports of subsidiaries, I think could be fair to say. Barbara, can you comment further on that?
No, I think that's fair to say. And in fact, I think I'll go as far to say that I'm not aware that there are any standalone issuer broker dealers left. And so the significance of the broker-dealer subsidiary would vary depending on how material it is to the holding company's financials.
Yeah, Kurt, no. We're not looking at anything related to the custody of customer funds at those entities.
So this would be, from our perspective, the audit standards of the broker-dealer standing alone and the compliance reports and the standards with respect to those compliance reports would be a new activity for us, as would be the inspection of the broker-dealer. Denny Beresford.
I'm on the board of a large public company that has about $650 billion under management. A very, very tiny portion of that is with respect to broker-dealers. Most of it is registered mutual funds and other forms of asset management. My point is simply that as you study this, I urge you to look at similar businesses. I believe there's a investment company audit guide that arguably has identical practices. I'm not sure if there are any others that are similarly situated, and as you look at this, I think that you should be concerned about precedents that you might be setting. I'm not suggesting that there are any particular problems here. I think that the assets under management are the big issue, as others have already suggested, but I'm simply saying, as you look at this, I think you should be aware of other practices in similar businesses at the same time.
Thanks. Bill Gradison.
Simply like to call to your attention that the board put out for comment a proposed confirmation rule, and this has direct implications here. But generally speaking, at least in my experience, when we talk about a box count, most of these securities are not in the possession of the broker-dealer. They're somewhere else. They may be with another broker-dealer. They may be in an electronic form somewhere else. They may be floating around quite literally in a street name. They won't have the name necessarily of the broker involved. And therefore, some of the challenges that auditors are facing with regard to other forms of confirmation, disclaimers and so forth, conceivably could arise in this area as well. So I just want to connect the dots in terms of that. We weren't thinking, I don't remember our talking about the broker-dealer context when we talked about confirmations, but it's not irrelevant. And some of you, as you think about commenting on that, while we didn't specifically ask about that, might have some useful comments to make as it might apply in the future to broker-dealers.
Thanks, Bill. Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I wanted to make some comments on development of the audit standards in this space. And I've never audited a broker-dealer, so I can't say I have deep industry expertise, but I've done a lot of audits. And as I think about what this issue is, it doesn't look like a typical financial statement audit. It doesn't look like basically the environment that audit guide was really set for. And when you go back and think about whether we should start with a clean sheet of paper or whether you should be starting with the audit guide, I'm a little concerned about thinking of the audit guide, of updating the audit guide and tweaking it, because I just look at the material in Appendix C with the report there and the obviously discontinuity between a disclaimer of opinion on controls immediately followed by an opinion based on a study. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I would really encourage the board, thinking about establishing a standard, to start where Barbara suggested, understand the risk, what problem are we trying to solve, think about the risks, think about how you then will address those risks and design the standards around that. While it's not to ignore this audit guide, it really needs to be focused on what we're trying to really accomplish and not starting by updating something that I, by my brief observation, looks kind of flawed in trying to solve this problem.
Thank you. Jeanette Frenzel?
In fact, I was going to make much of the same point there that Doug did. I think you really need to come to terms with what this opinion really means, and is the current model really addressing that level of assurance? And then based on risk, what do you really want an opinion on? And there is a loose parallel in the government world where we do require opinions on compliance for recipients of federal funding who carry out government programs. And there's a standard to deal with that opinion, and there's also a regulation, and there's also an audit guide. So I think you need to look at all the different levels that might be needed here.
Thank you. Damon Silver?
I confess, like some of the, I think like Kurt, I'm not sure I fully understand all this, but I have two general observations about it. The first is that it appears to me that Congress, in its infinite wisdom, knows what it wants, but not who it wants it from. And that it may not be too late to get at least a little clarification on that question. It appears that what Congress wants and what I know the public wants is some greater degree of assurance that what broker-dealers tell the public is in their accounts is actually there. That sounds pretty simple to me. Getting that assurance seems, after the last round of 10 or 12 comments, to be extraordinarily complicated. But it appears to lie somewhere between the PCAOB, FINRA, the SEC, and perhaps FASB, which hasn't been mentioned in this conversation. It strikes me that if the PCAOB wanted some greater degree of clarity, that it might be possible in what remains of the time before the Dodd-Frank bill is voted on final passage to have some sort of colloquy or the like among the sponsors of that bill that would direct all these various bodies to work together to achieve the goal that I mentioned earlier. There are certainly people involved with the PCAOB who know far more about these procedural matters in Congress than I do, but it strikes me that's at least one thing that might be done that might facilitate the interagency aspect of this. Secondly, but let me just say that substantively, it seems to me, again, in a very kind of sort of ignorant way, that what we're looking for here, it appears, is to have a process by which it appears that what Congress would like to have is to have auditors look at customer accounts and make sure that what's there is there. And so then the question is how to make that happen. And I couldn't tell you how to make that happen, but it strikes me that if you get Congress to say that clearly to everyone who has responsibility for it, maybe that would help. Second point, Bill Gradison's mentioning confirmations. In doing, it seems to me it's increasingly the case that in the securities markets and in things related to the securities markets like derivatives, we live in a world where acts with legal and accounting consequences occur with less formality than used to be the case. I think that maybe that's fairly Bill's point. The parties involved and their counsels to these transactions seem to have not a lot of problem in defining who has what asset, liability, and obligation. Meaning that whether it's an OTC derivative settled by a phone, entered into by a phone call initially, or a holding in a security that is evidenced by any of the things that Bill mentioned, private parties don't seem to have much of a problem knowing what's what, and it strikes me that there's not that actually that much lack of certainty here, and there ought to be a way that the PCAOB is able to define clearly in the course of its oversight of auditors of broker-dealers whether or not they're doing an adequate job at determining what the actual assets and accounts of the broker-dealers are.
Thanks, Damon. Jim Schnur.
Marty, just in terms of getting your information around your background, the AICPA has an expert panel with respect to broker-dealers. I think there are a wealth of information in terms of not only what the existing practices are, but also understanding the stock record, which is, I think, the focus of what the audit procedures would be, how that interrelates with the other records of the company in terms of their financial statements. And I think they could be very helpful in terms of developing, what the objective is, what the understanding of the records are, and then formulating, what the audit procedures ought to be and how they ought to, if they need to be changed from what's currently performed.
Thanks. We have reached out and had the expert panel visit with us and talk about how they're performing audits today, and we've had discussions in that regard. So we are, good point. We've been doing some of that outreach already, and we'll continue to do that to understand what has been done in the past. But I think one of the key things is they can talk about what has been done in the past, but there aren't a lot of standards and written standards today with respect to that. So one of the things we sort of find out is if you looked from one audit to another, you'd probably see a lot of differences, especially around this aspect of reporting on the safeguarding of assets that aren't in the financial statements, and the reporting on controls is probably quite variable because of the lack of existing auditing requirements in that area. And that's, I think, our biggest challenge is what those requirements would be around auditing something that's not in the financial statements, that's not disclosed. As I think Barbara touched on before, it's sort of the unique situation there. But your point is still good. We are reaching out to FINRA, the SEC, having conversations a lot with the SEC, and expert panels and others. I think it was Lynn and then Barbara Roper.
Thanks, Marty. I would wholeheartedly agree with Wayne that you really ought to start with the existing audit guide. I think it provides a good starting point. I would bring into that, though, an examination of the enforcement actions that have occurred at the SEC. And I think as you dig through those, you'll find that quite often the problem in this area is just a lack of expertise and supervision. Firms that have gotten in trouble have tended to put younger, junior people on these audits, and haven't adequately supervised them. They're not aware of all the laws and regulations, and as a result, they don't get to the heart of the issue. The other thing, and this has been highlighted in by the recent financial crisis, is with the broker-dealers, often we find that the auditors just really didn't understand what the broker-dealer was doing and the full scope and everything that the broker-dealer encompassed, including, as Barb has noted, the off-balance sheet stuff. And so I would certainly enhance that audit guide in those areas to make sure that people are actually starting to really understand these things, because they can be extremely or get into extremely complex transactions at times. On top of that, I would bring in the Yellow Book requirements. I think Jeanette was dead on, and I would bring in the full piece of the Yellow Book, including the notion of some form of negative reporting with respect to laws and regulations, because in this area, if the auditors hasn't really got in and understood all that, there's just no way they can really be doing an audit. So certainly I'd encompass that into the audit guide, including the possibility of a separate report in the area of laws and regulations and compliance as well. Denny made a good point. I too serve on the board of a mutual fund complex, and it ties in with what Bill said. These securities are often held by a custodian in a trust someplace, and it's becoming much more important from the perspective that funds have done much greater allocations to foreign investments, if you will. And we're finding as you start to invest in some of these foreign instruments that it's gotten very tough, if almost impossible, to be able to get a confirmation out of some of those foreign countries. And in some cases, the laws actually prevent them from providing that confirmation back to the auditor, especially in some of the Asian countries. So I think it's very important, even in your confirmation proposal, that you take on this issue, because it affects not only broker-dealers, it affects all 40 Act companies, and anyone that's holding or having securities held in those foreign countries by those custodians. And the auditor isn't going to get a confirmation. That's just the bottom line. So in those countries where you can't get a confirmation, we definitely need some guidance, some good guidance on exactly what we'd expect the auditor to do in those situations. And the more of that you can build into the current proposal before you finalize it, the better off I think you'll be in the long run. If you use the current audit guide, though, as a basis, I don't think this is going to be a real long-term project. I mean, you've spent 8 years on confirmations. I would hope we wouldn't spend 8 years. And anytime I hear anyone in Washington, D.C. saying it's going to take a long time,
it's only 6.
You know, it makes me nervous. I think you can get that expertise and get around your hands around it in a reasonable time without taking another 6 years to be able to put out a standard in this place.
Thanks. Barbara?
Yeah, 2 points. One, building on what you said, you know, in terms of reaching out to SEC and FINRA, it strikes me that the primary responsibility for overseeing the broker's custody of these securities is still a regulatory responsibility that resides with others. So it's going to be primarily an SEC or FINRA responsibility rather than a PC, that your particular role is looking at the role of the auditor in that process. And so some of the best guidance, I think, on what is effective or what procedures are appropriate to try to inspect for or audit for this custody of, you know, proper custody, safeguarding of customer securities, is going to come from sources like FINRA and the SEC in terms of looking at what they're doing, how they go about it. And I know you're already having those conversations, and I think that's useful. But I think at the outset there needs to be some thought about exactly what the auditors, you know, where they fit into this picture, because you can't write their standards until you know exactly which piece of this puzzle is going to be their responsibility. The other thing that strikes me is that the big risk here is where you have self-custodying. You know, I mean, that's where the risk levels, that was the case in the Madoff example. A lot of these examples that you're talking about, with investment companies, they're probably not self-custodying. So you already have a third party in that process where there's some independence. So the big risk factors in terms of problems that are likely to occur are going to occur where you have the broker-dealer who is self-custodying. And then I think you have to look at a much more robust set of audit procedures in order to assure that everything is appropriate.
I agree. Good comments. Thank you. Sam Ranzilla?
Well, I think it's important to recognize here that, you know, that in addition to the guide, there are attestation standards that exist with respect to a report on compliance or reports on controls over compliance. So, I mean, to say we're starting with a fresh sheet of paper, I think there are solutions within the standards. There might be a need for practice aids or something, but you can't really answer that question, in my mind, until the SEC makes a decision on what they're going to do to amend 17A5. And I think it's really important, and I think I'm stating the obvious, so I'll back off, but it's very important to be fully coordinated with the SEC on this, from both the perspective of the writing of the standards as well as the transition from the old regime to the new regime, that, you know, appropriate considerations with respect to that transition period, and how quickly both broker-dealers and auditors can integrate that into their processes.
Thanks, Sam. Bill Gradison?
I'd just like to say a word about expectations. One of these years, the SEC is going to replace me, so I'm just speculating on what the future may bring. But I think the sum of what we've discussed, what has been discussed so far, is that next year is going to be a learning year. When I said a blank sheet, all I mean is you can't take our current auditing standards and apply them. Furthermore, if our inspectors go out and work against the documents that are already in use, what are they inspecting against? And that all has to be filled in. So, you know, realistically, I think it'd be quite miraculous if this program were truly operational until the year after next. And I don't say that with a great satisfaction, but I just think one has to be realistic about what's involved. In other words, I think of 2011 with regard to broker-dealer audit oversight is somewhat like 2003 with regard to issuers, where we did limited inspections, and they were very useful, but they were limited in their scope as compared with what we were able to do a year or so later.
Yeah, certainly with respect to the audits of the fundamental financial statements of the broker-dealer, many of our existing auditing standards would be entirely appropriate with respect to the audit of the financial statements of the broker-dealer. The biggest issue might be these 500 or so firms that are just registering with us that are not used to certain new standards that we've issued, such as our documentation standards or EQR and other things like that, that they would have to get up to speed on. But there's probably some other transition issues as well, as Bill's talked about, and I think Brian mentioned before, of suddenly authority is given to us, and what's the appropriate transition period to move from what auditors are currently doing today to something else. And I agree with all the comments that have made that there's lots of stuff to consider there's audit guides, there's knowledge at FINRA and the SEC, there's certainly attestation standards and other tools that we can start to build upon. So we acknowledge that and don't expect a six-year process to get this done, Lynn. We understand it's going to be a degree of urgency around this, but clearly something we have to approach with great care, given the fact that we're talking about custody of trillions of dollars of assets, and we're all aware of some of the frauds that have taken place and how monumental they were. So we certainly want to make sure that the right standards are put forth. Neary Buxbaum.
Thanks, Marty. Just a quick observation is what strikes me that there's an element here, and maybe beyond the scope of the board, for some, you know, principle-based construction and engineering, no pun intended, in the context of AICPA guides. But if you think about the need to audit information that's not in the financial statements and apply some verification processes, the need arises in many other areas. It's very high on my mind now in the context of emerging Reg AB, securitization transactions, and looking at some things that are not on the financial statements. Another element that comes to mind, and I know how it falls within the realms of the broker-dealers, is insurance separate accounts. And it could be somewhat related because it's also an element of financial statements of insurers, and it's a build-up of all the separate accounts, notwithstanding the fact that it's not directly on their balance sheets per se. Or perhaps it is. I'm not sure whether how you treat it because it's a line below the financial statements. But in this regard, what strikes me as interesting is to think about, one, perhaps it's a second opinion rather than and something you can couple. Two, create some building blocks, perhaps together with the AICPA, of what does it mean to audit something that looks like this and feels like that, rather than creating a unique artifact that is solely for broker-dealers. And that's kind of allows you, should there be, the next request will be to get the PCAOB overseeing some attestation reports associated, for example, with emerging Reg AB. So it's just a thought whether some thinking could be expanded beyond simply broker-dealers in conjunction of a larger exercise.
Thanks, Neary. Good points. Galen Hansen?
Yeah, it seems to me, and Sam mentioned this as well as Neb right now, the attestation standards, it almost seems to me that is more of where you're going rather than the traditional audit financial statements. I did have a couple questions, Marty. How have they even mentioned how often these are going to, are we looking at triennial audits like we have right now? Has there been any discussion of that, or whether these inspection reports would be made public? As I understand it, the existing Section 70GA audits are not even made public, right? Those are filed with the SEC, and they're not even subject to public scrutiny. Is that the case?
I think, Galen, and Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, broker-dealer financials can be filed on a confidential basis with the SEC. They are required to provide their customers with an audited balance sheet audit at least once a year, but the 17A5 report, and that would be kept confidential if they so request.
The way the legislation works is we'd simply have the discretion to set an inspection schedule, and you might have a different frequency schedule for different types of broker-dealers.
Sam Renzilla.
I just wanted to follow up to Bill's comment. I think a timeline, Bill, that you're talking about with respect to using 2011 as a bridge allows for the appropriate time to both set the standards for the SEC to modify their rules. So I just wanted to say, from my perspective at least, that sounds like a very reasonable approach.
Lynn Turner.
Another source of information for you, Marty, I think, is to sit down with the actual examiners at the SEC. Not necessarily the headquarter people, but you should go spend some time with the examiners or broker-dealers in the regional offices. These are the people, and there's some, I know there's some former Big Four auditors in some of those regional offices that are actually in examining these broker-dealers, and I think they would be an invaluable, I found them an invaluable source in the past of information. and they've got the auditing skill set, plus they have probably the most in-depth knowledge of broker-dealers of anyone within the commission. So I would certainly try to reach out to the regional offices and get your hands on some of the people actually doing the examination of the broker-dealers.
Good. Thanks, Lynn. Well, hopefully, I'll turn this back to Barbara in a second for some summary comments, but hopefully we've tried to at least put the issue on the table and explain why there's some challenges here, and we've certainly gotten a lot of good advice in terms of where we should go with next steps. Brian did talk about transition issues and looking at 17A5, and then certainly we'll look at other guidance that exists and standards that exist to try to draw from that with respect to the unique aspects of the broker-dealer, not their basic fundamental financials, but the unique aspects we talked to. Barbara?
Thank you again for your comments. I think this will be very, very helpful to us and very informative. I guess just two topics I wanted to briefly throw out since we have about 10 minutes left. I think they've been touched on in some of the remarks. And one has to do with maybe any views or suggestions on this issue of outsourcing. I've spent a good part of my career in financial services, both on the issuer side and the auditing side. And I think there is a lot of outsourcing. And then, you know, we could talk about getting SAS 70s, but then you go to the SAS 70 and there's a two-page list of subservicers, which are really not covered, as my understanding is, under the SAS 70. So one is if anyone has any views or suggestions. I think that we may find with some of these broker-dealers that the outsourcing arrangements are significant, and it will differ very much from broker to broker. And the other issue is, I know this gets more back to the broker-dealer financial statements, but it's important in customer protection, which is I recently read that even though we seem to be kind of on the economic recovery path, there have been a number of broker-dealers that have broken their net capital requirements this year. And they're not the largest ones, but they're not insignificant. I think one in June had 300 independent representatives that broke their net capital and are now in liquidation. So I don't know if anyone has any views on whether this, looking at the net capital requirement, since it's as of a point in time, if there should be any other considerations that within the next month net capital might not be adequate. Damon?
I wanted to respond to your second question. We've seen a fair amount of sort of volatility in the equities markets, meaning that we had extraordinary volatility in 2008 and early 2009, then a period of relative calm, and now in the last 3 or 4 months, a return to higher than average volatility. And I think these kinds of conditions support the concern you raised in your second question. I think there's also would also be reason for concern about capital over time. This is less a small broker-dealer question than a large broker-dealer question. Due to the availability to large institutions of very cheap short-term finance now for a protracted period of time, and I think it's likely, although it's very foolish to make these kinds of predictions, I think it's likely that that's going to continue for a while, at least if the Fed Fed statements are to be believed. I think that creates a circumstance where broker-dealers are very vulnerable to a market break of some kind, and where there isn't, I think, the underlying stability in the financial markets to make that type of break implausible.
Lynn Turner?
On the second point, as Damon mentioned, there's a lot of volatility, but I mean an auditor his job is to opine on those financials at a point in time and not to try to be forecasting out what's going to happen in the capital markets. I mean, we're having a difficult time forecasting out what's going to happen in today's market, let alone what's going to happen over the course of the next year. And there's already the obligation on the part of the auditor with respect to going concern, it almost seems like it's more of a disclosure issue from the context of what the broker-dealer is going to disclose in terms of capital and contingencies around that capital and the ability to maintain their net capital over the course of the going year. And in a world that's so volatile, I think maybe emphasize the going concern requirements, but trying to get out beyond a year is almost impossible these days. And, you know, I just no one seems to be doing a good job on it. So I'd be careful in that respect. As far as the outsourcing, I assume you're talking about the broker dealers outsourcing some of the stuff like the custodianship and all.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it just gets back to the point I made earlier, that the auditor really has to understand exactly what the nature of the operations of the broker-dealer is, who's doing it, and who's responsible for that stuff. And I think that's where the breakdown has come in the SEC enforcement cases, because the auditors tend to look at just what's on the balance sheet and not what's missing. And it's not just broker-dealers. One could say that has to do with a lot of the off-balance sheet problems we've had.
Okay. Thank you. Damon, did you have another comment?
I'm not sure, Lynn. I may not have expressed myself clearly. I was not suggesting that auditors ought to be trying to forecast capital markets. That would be very foolish. What I was suggesting was that in the course of opining on the fairness and accuracy of the financial statement as a whole, that auditors ought to be looking a single moment in time in terms of measuring the capital adequacy of a broker dealer could be misleading in a sense it's not only possible, it's quite easy to engineer financial statements around a single moment in time, and the auditor ought to be paying it for the reasons I said earlier. An auditor ought to be paying attention to the capital levels over time within the firm, not predicting them for years to come, but looking at them in the current year in a broader way than just a single moment. Even if the reg requires in particular that the broker dealer have capital at a single moment.
Okay, Al Schroeder.
Yeah, I think there is actually a requirement, and SEC can help me out on this. I thought there was actually a requirement for all broker dealers to monitor on an ongoing basis their capital requirement. And it seems like as part of the audit process itself, the auditor should be looking at their ability to comply with this regulation along with others. So I think Damon's right that we're kind of there. Maybe it needs to be spelled out more in the procedures.
Art?
My memory may be failing me here, but I do think that broker-dealers, don't they file monthly focus reports? And those focus reports have the net capital computation in, if I recall right. So from an audit perspective, I think Lynn's right. If a broker-dealer is getting into a net capital problem, it raises a going concern issue. And you see information throughout the year from these focus reports as to their net capital, and those net capital computations take into account haircuts on securities and so forth. So there's a lot of information with respect to that.
At Wayne, Collins?
Just a slight add-on to that. There is, as part of the 17A5 and as part of what the auditor is reporting on right now on the material inadequacies, is the companies making the periodic computations of net capital. So I think that handles what the fluid performance during the year.
Well, thank you very much for your comment. I'm sorry, was there one more comment? Doug? Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to get back to your other question on the outsourcing of the activities. I mean, at the end of the day, if an auditor is going to give some kind of attestation or opinion on whether it's accuracy of records or adequacy of procedures and controls, they're taking responsibility for that. Now, if they're relying on the work of somebody else or information that's coming from some other party, they have some obligation to have some basis to decide it's accurate or it's supportable. I know my view has always been you can outsource whatever you want, but you can only outsource the activities. You can't outsource the responsibility. So if the auditor is going to give an opinion in some way, they have the responsibility to make sure that opinion is supported, regardless of who's doing the activity. So I don't see it as a complicated topic. It's a topic that auditors have been dealing with for decades. It just may be a little more extreme here, which means there has to be a very good risk assessment before the auditor can decide what to do. maybe more complex risk assessment than it is in other situations, but it's not a new topic.
Thanks, Doug. Well, again, I think by bringing this topic to the SAG today, we wanted to address something that was going to be before us, we think, very shortly based upon on legislation. Let you know that we've been having conversations with the SEC, FINRA, expert panels, et cetera, and that we're planning to address this matter on an expedited basis, understanding all of the importance of it and the risks involved. So thanks very much for the input. We're going to take a try to take a short break, about 15 minutes, and then we're going to turn to our next topic. Thank you.